I wanted to start with just a reminder to let you all know that we are taping the call. And then I had on the agenda, the first item on the agenda was something that probably should have done with the first call, but better late than never. I wanted to make sure that we were all on the same page about the charge of the council. Hello, somebody just joined?
Hey, good morning. This is Greg Paskatch with Mosaic.
Good morning, Greg. Glad you could join us.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, you want to just maybe go around and let's just introduce everyone again. So Greg?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I'm sorry, you're with who, Greg? You wanted to
Yeah, I'm with Mosaic.
Mosaic, yes.
Yep.
Okay.
And I'm Megan Spester. I work in legal in TDHCA. And I'm going to be the TDHCA's legal advisor to the larger committee. And Terry thought it was a good idea that I meet folks on these calls so that I'm not meeting everyone the first time next time we have a committee.
Yeah.
Thanks, Megan.
And I'm Darla Gay with the Reentry Roundtable in Austin, Texas.
I'm Linda Ender with the Senior Source in Dallas.
And this is Elizabeth Yavich here, Director of Housing Resource Center at TDHCA.
We also have Jeff.
Sorry, I had it on mute. Jeff Woolliford with the Texas Veterans Commission in Austin.
Thank you. I think that was everybody, right? Anybody else? And then also just a reminder not to put your phone on hold. Mute is fine, but hold, we get the elevator music. So if you would, please don't do that. So the agenda, the first item on the agenda was to review the statute for the council. So we talked about it the first call. Good morning. Somebody just joined the call? Might have lost somebody. Anyway, what we're working towards with these work groups is to identify strategies that are going to be included in the biennial plan that we're going to be submitting to the governor and the Legislative Budget Board in August of 2014. So we developed that plan and submit it every other year. And so what we are working towards is trying to develop some strategies that we can include in that report. So I wanted to go back to the duties of the council and really kind of start there to make sure that we're all on the same page as what we're trying to accomplish. And so just going back to the statute, it's the Texas Government Code 2306.1096. The council shall develop and implement policies to coordinate and increase state efforts to offer service-enriched housing, to identify barriers preventing or slowing service-enriched housing efforts, including barriers attributable to the following factors: regulatory requirements and limitations, administrative limitations, limitations on funding, and ineffective or limited coordination. They're also charged with developing a system to cross-educate selected staff in state housing and health services agencies to increase the number of staff with expertise in both areas and to coordinate relevant staff activities at those agencies. We're also to identify opportunities for state housing and health services agencies to provide technical assistance and training to local housing and health services entities about the cross-education of staff, coordination among those entities, and opportunities to increase local efforts to create service-enriched housing, and also to develop suggested performance measures to track progress in the reduction or elimination of barriers in creating service-enriched housing, increasing the coordination between state housing and health services agencies, increasing the number of state housing and health services staff who are cross-educated or who have expertise in both housing and health services programs, and the provision of technical assistance to local communities by state housing and health services staff to increase the number of service-enriched housing projects. And then, as I mentioned before, we're to create, to develop a biennial plan to implement the goals that I just described, and submit that report with the Council's findings and recommendations to the Governor and Legislative Budget Board on August 1st of 2014. So I just kind of wanted to go back and review the statute and make sure that we sort of, that we are continuing to use that as the foundation as we move forward. So does anybody have any questions, comments about that?
So yeah, just one question. I'm looking on the website, and what you just read, is it on the website somewhere so that we have access to it?
Yes, it is. If you just go to the home page, TDHDA's home page, and on the left-hand side, you'll see a navigator button that says Governing Statute. And then once you go into the statute, you can just do a, what is it, Control F, and then just search for 2306, and it actually starts at .1091. And what I
okay, so I'm already lost. So just I'll look for it. But one recommendation may be that where you have the work group listed with the information about the next meeting, maybe you can add a link to that so that if people are interested in, you know, getting involved in these work groups, they can find the document that says, and this is what our charge of that work group is, to simplify it, because now, you know, I'll have to go and back. I can't do it today. I'm going to have to, I mean, during the call, I'm going to have to work at finding it. And I just think it would be easier if it was on this page.
On which page? Okay, so what I did was I put a link on the agenda that is on the web page that goes directly to the governing statute. So then.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But then I have to go and
right.
Scroll all the way down to that, okay.
2306.1091. Yeah, and I tried to just do it where it would go directly to that, but you really
it won't do that.
That won't okay. do that.
What was it?
2306.1091. That's where it starts.
Okay. Thanks.
And I do think it's great if we all are familiar with that and make sure we are always keeping that in mind as we develop these recommendations. Make sure we're following the statute. That's always a good idea. Any other questions, comments? And thank you for the feedback. I do want to try to make it as easy as possible to find things. And if I come up with any other great ideas of making it easier, I'll try to do that. Any other comments? Shall we go ahead and move on then? What I really wanted to do was just go back and make sure that I have captured what we talked about on the first call. And so I had four items that I captured, and I just want to review those and make sure that that's what, I know there's several of you that were on the first call, and just see if I captured them. So the first one that came up was to create incentives in the qualified allocation plan for for-profit corporations. That was something that came up as a recommendation.
And so why would we do for-profit? Is it already in there for nonprofits?
Yes. Nonprofits is actually a statutorily directed set-aside. And so we are required to offer incentives to nonprofits. They have a specific set aside in the qualified allocation plan.
Okay.
And so the comment was, let's try to come up with some incentives to, you know, encourage more for-profits to develop service-enriched housing projects. Any other comments about that first one?
Well, this is Greg with Mosaic. I was just thinking that, you know, the recommendations outlined by TAC and the service-enriched housing finance practices that was put out, I think a lot of those are applicable towards for-profit or nonprofit. I mean, whatever developer is able to produce those outcomes, I think is perfectly fine, and both should be eligible to go after those incentives.
Mm-hmm. And currently in the QAP, both are. We do have nonprofit
okay.
and for-profits, yeah, that do go after those tax credits.
Yeah, but specifically if there were incentives, you know, towards service-enriched housing targeting requirements or those kind of things, if there were additional incentives created, I agree they should be open to both.
Okay, open to both, yeah, great. Thanks, Greg. Anybody else? Okay. The next one I captured was provide additional points for developers, and that would be in the qualified allocation plan again, for developers who agree to provide an on-site case manager. So the way I understood that would be a case manager that would be on-site. I don't think we really talked about whether the person would be an employee or contract, but would be somebody that would be on-site to help coordinate.
You know,
so,
I apologize. I just joined. But that was what I had brought up last time. And I think the fact of whether the person will be part-time and full-time would maybe be adjusted depending on the number of units
that are
in the complex. But I think I don't think it really matters whether it's an employee or a contractor. It's just a matter of maybe 40 hours a week for a complex over 180 units and maybe 20 hours a week for something under 150 units or something like that.
Okay.
Well, it also depends on the level of service needs that they're going to be serving there. So it's not specifically based on the number of units. In fact, I would say number of people or number of families served, because if you have 100 units and 80 of those units are families that need support, one case manager will not do it. So I think it's a minimum
of that. Right now there's none. Right? I mean, there's no requirement for that right now. But you know, I don't know how, as they get into the tax credit process, I think that there's got to be a clean-cut thing, because it gets too complicated for them to explain the point system, I think. That's just my thought. Go ahead.
Is this Marty?
This is Marty.
Yes. Okay, Marty. Glad you joined us. So I heard a couple things. You know, were you agreeable that perhaps it should be dependent on the number of families who need services? You originally talked about units, but
see, the problem I think with these projects is if they're going for tax credits and we're looking at tax credit points, they're not necessarily looking at whatever the service component is in regards to what the target audience is, other than the fact whether it's families or seniors. That's real, or I guess families, seniors, or they're looking for, homeless housing. I think are the three areas that they talk that are specifically set out in the tax credit. Is that correct?
Well, you mean as far as, like, special needs populations?
No, as far as how they would divide out as they look at somebody applying for tax credits. I think there's a set aside for homeless, but I think then other than that set aside, I think isn't it specifically just whether you're serving individuals or families, or you're serving seniors. Is that correct?
Well, what you know, my reading of the draft 2014 qualified allocation plan. There are two additional points that developers can, you know, apply to receive, and it's if they offer supportive housing services. And there is a list of those services, and they're required to select which of those services, and there's a minimum number they have to select in order to receive those points.
And so
they select those services during the process. I do know that they can change some of those services, you know, after the development is built, but they still have to have a minimum number of services that are offered.
I'm
not sure if there's any kind of requirement that they notify us that they've changed those services. I don't know about that.
This is Megan. This is something that is going into effect in January 2014. For properties that have selected amenities, when folks move in, or at lease renewal, when folks move in, they're given a copy. They will be given a copy of the amenities, including services or whatever that the developer has agreed to provide. And then if that amenity changes through the departments, then they have to get permission to change that amenity from the department. And if that amenity changes, they're given notice of what those amenities or services are. Starting in January.
I was in Austin when the gentleman brought that up, and I'm so glad they implemented it. I haven't had a chance to look at that, but that is really great news that they're going to make them let all the people know. And that's great. That's very, very good. Do you see the case manager as being one of those amenities, or do you see it as us suggesting that this be a different point than that? In other words, can they choose? Do you see that being this suggestion as being they can choose a case manager as one of those entities, meaning that after the fact they can not have a case manager and do something instead of that? Or do you see it as a separate point item where if you have a case manager, you're going to get another 2 points?
Well, you know, the QAP changes every year.
Sure.
So it depends on, you know, what version of the QAP we're talking about. In some years, social services has been a separate point item,
uh-huh.
And in some years, it's been a list of services that they could choose.
Yes. And I know they're trying to get away from developers having to make a concrete list going forward, that they're getting into just here's the flexible list. As long as you agree to apply at least 10 of these at all times, we don't care what 10 you provide. And as the person just said, I guess that they're going to have to notify the residents if they change. But as we suggest the need for case managers, my suggestion would be that would be a different point item.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to being on that menu, because I think I would not like to have a developer after the fact say, no, we decided not to do a case manager. We decided to do one of the other things on the list instead because of the fact that a case manager is an expensive cost. There's no doubt about it. And my experience with these people is once they get it up and running and leased up, then they're just constantly looking for cost-cutting measures to improve their bottom line. And I think that this would have to be something that is mandated. If they get the points for it, it's mandated that they continually have this person there through the regulatory period.
So if I could just bring us up a little bit from this discussion, should we have a recommendation as a subset of this that, you know, that there's, you know, that there's the implementation discussion around how that doesn't happen, you know, so that, it's going to be an implementation that would be the issue rather than the overarching recommendation that we're talking about. So maybe that's the implementation. Maybe the recommendation is that, you know, we have to pay attention to implementation and post-award, that doesn't get diluted.
Yeah, and they need to do that across the board, because I have seen so many of the complexes that after the fact are providing kind of ghost services, and somehow they get credit for them. And I just think that across the board they need to really be looking at developers accountable.
And that's where, Terry, that when you use the word case manager, it means different things to different people.
Uh-huh.
So, I think that may need to be clarified in the recommendation, you know, what type and how much depth that case manager is. Is it just an events coordinator that helps people, you know, get involved? Does it make referrals? Because referrals alone is not case management. Is it, you know, leading groups, you know, at the site? I mean, that's the thing, is everybody looks at what a case manager is and does perhaps differently.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's a very, very good point. And I think that, in my opinion, in bringing this up, I don't see this at all as an activity coordinator or a, I absolutely see it as someone looking at families' individual needs or seniors' individual needs and being able to link them with resources in the community to meet those needs, whether it's health-related or school-related or whatever it is. But
So, Terry, is that the vision that you guys think the council has of what a case manager is?
Well, I mean, I don't think there is I don't think the council at this point has a vision of what a case manager is. I think that, you know, as I kind of mentioned, the goal of the council is to increase service-enriched housing, and what does that look like, you know, and that's housing and services staff communicating and coordinating. The big picture is how to keep people in their homes, in the community, rather than, you know, institutions.
I think that's the language you put under then what a case manager does: build self-sufficiency, maintains housing stability, and good client outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
So say that again, please.
Maintain housing stability.
Housing stability, yeah.
Achieve good client outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
I think link residents with community services.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's part of maintaining the housing stability. There's a bunch of strategies that goes with that. It's the key is, but what response, you know, I don't want them to be just a linker. If they're going to be on site.
I agree. But I think, and when you say housing stability, I mean, when you're talking about health issues or other issues, I don't see that as part of, in many cases, maintaining housing stability. I think there's, I guess that's how I see it when you say that, so.
We think that terminology is can be interpreted in a lot of different ways, and you really need to be very clear.
Yeah.
Well, that goes to implementation. That's the problem with, you know, getting recommendations at a macro level, is in it's the implementation. What does that mean at implementation? And I don't know if that's the level we're supposed to be at. Are we supposed to be there, Terry?
Well, I mean, I think what we're trying to do is to brainstorm on recommendations to get to the end goal, which is increasing service-enriched housing. And what I'm hearing is that Marty says in order to do that, from what your experience is, having on-site case manager, service coordinator, social worker, whatever you want to call that person, is critical.
I'm going to tell you, I was involved in three different forums up here, primarily related to housing for people with intellectual disabilities, and I can tell you the biggest barrier we hit in every one of them was funding for the case manager piece of it. Somebody on site there all the time, and one of the things was maintaining housing. Was that being a liaison between some of those residents and the property management, because the management will just get frustrated with them, and they'll just evict them just because they don't have time to deal with them. And if you have that middle person, that liaison in there that's responsible for taking some of that on and helping that, I mean, that was really the key issue that came up in all three of the forums that we were in.
And therein lies a built-in concern of mine with this recommendation, is that if the developer is being tapped with the responsibility of ensuring that case manager becomes an employee of the developer.
Yeah.
And so you really won't see that there's going to be some issues. Right.
Yeah, I see that too, but I don't know. I mean, without it, you get it from nowhere. In other words, I don't know. I realize it's maybe the less of two evils, but if these developers are making, most of them, the for-profit developers, they are not coming in and spending $50,000 or $100,000 to roll the dice to make an application because they're not making some very good money on these developments. I can tell you the reason why you have 35 people applying for seven spots or whatever it is is because there's some good money in it. And so that's what we think we've got to tap into, because if you get away from there, then the only ones that provide it are the true for-profits like Foundation Communities and the ones, I know there's several in Houston that are doing it, that are doing an incredible job at it, but the for-profit ones are making big money, and we've got to tap into that resource somehow, I think.
Okay. So I hear a concern about the case manager being an employee of the developer. But in the ideal world, right, a developer, your landlord or your property management, it's in their best interest to keep those units full, right, and not be vacant, not lose tenants, right? So, if you have someone, let's say, the person's not paying their bill or they have other kinds of issues, if you had a case manager on site that could intervene, that's kind of what I'm hearing, is an intervention early on that could perhaps assist that person. Like they could assist that person to maintain that housing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
Yeah, because they might need a money manager. They are not able to develop a budget to keep themselves on track. They might need they might apply for some program, like to help them with their health insurance or something that frees up resources to be able to stretch their dollars to pay their rent. I mean, there's all kinds of things, that caseworker could do to assist that person.
So,
and that's to benefit, everybody.
Perhaps somebody, with a mental illness that maybe is hoarding things in their apartment or something, and they aren't aware of and have not been connected with the mental health services in their community. That would be something that an on-site case manager would know who to connect that person with. Same with somebody with an intellectual disability, maybe a family member with a child with autism, isn't familiar with any of the Department of Aging and Disability Services staff. They could connect people. All before it gets to the crisis situation where the person is going back to the institution or they end up losing their housing, they end up losing their rental subsidy maybe in some cases. If they weren't, making sure that they go through the review process and send in their income. Is that kind of what we're all talking about?
Mm-hmm.
I agree with that.
A conflict of interest, really, would there be a conflict of interest if that case manager, even if that case manager was employed by the developer, the goal is to keep those folks housed and to keep those units full.
We've just completed a research project here in Austin looking at our local utilization of housing specialists, and that came up that case managers feel loyalty to their development provider.
Wherever their paycheck coming from.
So when it comes to making a decision about this person's got to go, they are not in a clear-cut advocacy role.
Yeah.
And so that, they do see decisions made that they don't think is in the best interest of their client, but it's in the best interest of the helper. So there are ways to work around it. There are ways to build capacity to do that. And I think our nonprofits in our state do it well. But I think as you get for-profits that's not done this before, that's where you're going to see at least some startup issues around this.
Yeah. So is it?
Well, I think they have to be an employee of the developer because, I mean, you know, you can't like make them have someone there on site that is hired and controlled by someone else.
You can contractually,
but you
can't. We do that here.
But yeah. What you can do is you can have like a an ombudsman situation or advocate situation, you know, where they're required to let tenants know about that advocate or ombudsman, whatever title you want to use. You could do that.
I just make sure the language does not specify that the developer has to be the one to hire that, because I think we need to make our developers have the option of contractually providing that service.
Oh, sure. I think so, too. And I think that would it be a suggestion that maybe that they have to provide a third-party non-for-profit, but they have to pay for it. They can't expect this to go on and the not-for-profit to fund it themselves. I think they have to foot the bill for it, but maybe we require them to hire a third-party nonprofit in the area to do it.
Yeah, I think a fee-for-service makes a lot more sense from a developer standpoint and efficient utilization of existing resources.
Can you tell me more what you mean by fee-for-service in this particular...
That the developer would, in essence, contract with the service provider and just pay the fee for the caseworker, because I'm also thinking in terms of the size of development and how many individuals may need assistance. We may have a caseworker who is working at maybe three different apartment complexes, so to speak, in order to equal that full-time paycheck for that staff member. So it just seems like that it would be a way to free up that staff, not associate it necessarily with a specific developer in terms of an employee, and, like I said, use the existing capacity and expertise of existing nonprofits.
And that's my bent. I just want to make sure the language doesn't limit that to happen.
Yeah.
But that's my particular bent as well.
Then would it be that, do you suggest that I'm not opposed to mandating that that's how they do it. I mean, just so you get that third party involved.
Would this be just mandating for the new for-profits? Is that what we're focusing on?
Yeah, I guess you're right. You're right. For for-profits, the problem you have is you have so many non-for-profits that are involved in these developments but really have no control over them. I mean, they're there really for the points. You know, I guess, it would have to be not for a non-for-profit that not only owns but also operates the property.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't be required to do a third party, have a third party person doing it. But any property operated by a for-profit company would be required to. I mean, that's just a suggestion.
Okay, so did I understand then that what you're talking about is there would be additional points only for for-profits to provide the case manager, but not additional points for nonprofits?
No.
Okay. No, I think the nonprofits do an exceptional job, and I think they should automatically get the points.
So it would just be for anyone. And the way I have it written right now was provide additional points for developers who agree to provide on-site case manager. Doesn't say contracted or anything like that or third party. It just says who agree to provide an on-site case manager. And then we would also put in there some words about what we mean by that. What kind of, you know, categories or big broad kind of duties that would entail. Maintain housing stability, you know, we could come up with some words related, you know, what kind of job description, if you will, only not down to that level of detail, but some overarching goals that the case manager would be, or responsibilities that the case manager would be charged with doing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree with the lady that said earlier that we need to get it to the point where it's very specific, because if it's not specific, I don't think I think a lot of them will figure out a way to get around it.
Okay, so more specific. Okay, so
and that's another specific piece is when is that service expected to kick in? Because I've seen it happen where somebody's agreed to do that, and then 2.5 years later, we're finding out it hadn't happened yet because we haven't finished rehabbing.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue, especially with lease-up, is those people need it right away. I mean,
day one,
moving into the community.
Right.
Day one, when the place begins to lease up, they need
the first. First occupied unit.
And I just want to clarify that the caseworker would, explicitly be serving the units that are set aside for the disabled or whatever that special needs or set aside population is. Is that correct?
No, I think it's for everyone. I think a lot of these people are going to would go for the point for units that aren't.
Yeah, but that's the easy part. See, that's my fear, is that they're going to hire, somebody that's going to do the easier part and not the harder part.
Yeah.
So I think that was the intention of the recommendation.
Yeah.
So then people that aren't, so you're not requiring a case manager for units that are being built that aren't specifically setting aside units? Because I really would like to see all of them have a requirement. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that there's, what needs to. I think the beautiful thing of being able to require this in the QAP is building in some expectation that the property owner or manager is going to identify. Let's just say we don't think people are needing case management services even on initial move-in. They got it together. But what happens if there's signs that they're starting to lose instability? That's when they need to be referred to case management.
Uh-huh.
Not walk-in services. Just to say, where's the nearest place I can go? I think there's a way that we can say the case manager is for those who need the intensive services to keep them housed,
yes,
rather than everybody needing those services.
Well,
but they can be available as a resource. But I think you're right. I think we need language that says the case management is primarily directed toward, the set aside the special population, but they can serve other people who are showing instability signs.
Well,
so if somebody's applying and they're not applying for a set aside for special population, we're not offering the place to them for offering a case management services to just a family community that's got lots of single mothers that are trying to deal with their kids?
Well, I think with limited resources, you have to figure out how to deploy those resources effectively. And, evidence shows that, you've got to do a more intensive for higher need. And so...
I'm not saying that the higher need shouldn't be the issue on properties that have special populations. I'm talking about the properties that are not applying for a set-aside for special populations to also be required to have a case manager on site for general population, but they don't have a special population to serve because they're not applying for the set aside.
Okay, so let me.
I don't know if we can do that.
Let me say what I thought I heard. In the current QAP, you get an additional. You can apply for additional 2 points for offering supportive housing. Mm-hmm. And so it is specific to, supportive housing and those services. Those services and the definition of our service-enriched housing is that those are voluntary and they can be on-site or they can be off-site. So, I think we're getting into a slippery slope if we say we're going to have management service here, but it's only going to be available for a certain population. to me, what it is you have a case manager that is going to be that resource or that service would be one of an array of services that would be available to whomever needs that service. That may not be somebody that's in one of the, you know, the 5% or the 2%, you know, housing that's set aside specifically for people. That may be somebody who is elderly, who has not applied for, you know, for any kind of benefits that, you know, would need linkage to services. And so then, you know, so within that QAP, it might look like, okay, you get 2 points for the supportive housing if you also agree to have as one of your, I can't remember what the number is, 5 or 6 services you provide, case management will give you 3 points.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a good way to make the incentive big enough that you're going to have more and more people going after it. And that will, in fact, right, create that competition and get people to provide that service.
So is everyone, are we kind of on the same page then if we say that we want, and I thought that's where you were going originally, Gary, was that it's an additional points for having this case manager on site. If you don't want to have the case manager, you can go back to the, you know, select the tax preparation or some of these other services that the developments offer, but you want to do the case manager and you're going to make sure that that service is available, then we're going to give you an extra point or points.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question? Under your scenario, is it only specifically offered to people that have already chosen the 2 points for special populations or supportive housing, or is that extra points for case manager available to any developer?
Well, the scenario I just described, I was envisioning it in the supportive housing for people
okay.
who are choosing supportive housing.
Okay.
Because that's
okay.
really what the council's charge is doing, is getting
yes.
that service enriched
sure.
housing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just want to say, for the record, you know, we can use that broad language and let's see where it goes, but I think you're going to end up with more navigator, caseworker, referral folks than you are a case manager based on definitions of what a case manager does.
Yeah.
And that may be fine, but I think it's still coming back to, you know, who they're going to serve and what level of services does that population need.
I think we could include in, I'm pretty sure the QAP, maybe, you know, offhand, has a definition section. And so maybe we can come up with what we really mean by a case manager and what those duties are going to be. And I know of some language that's at another state agency that maybe we could try to draft something that might be helpful.
Mm-hmm. And believe me, navigators are fine, caseworkers are fine. I mean, they're still going to probably get at the intent, which is making sure they get linked to the services they need. I think having a for-profit developer come in and hire a case manager, if they don't understand benefit applications or, you know, as an organization, then they're hiring somebody that, you know, they're depending on being the sole resource for that property for that information. So it just becomes a little dicey, I think.
Okay, I think I followed you on that. So let me, you know, I can see what maybe I can come up with for a definition of a case manager, and we could take it from there. And I don't know that we'd go down to that level of detail in the biennial.
Yeah, right. All right.
You know, but it would be something that, you know, we will start with public comment for the 2015. Public comment's already over for 2014. So what we're talking about here would be 15 and then 15, I guess, because our biennial plan is for 14 and 15. So it would be the next round of two qualified allocation plan developments. Okay. So let me just move on. So I've got a few minutes left. The third one that I captured from our first call was create more incentives for deeply affordable housing. which what I put in parentheses was 20% of the area median family income. So the way I read that was, let's put in where you can get, this is also in the qualified allocation plan, additional points if you set aside more units that are at 20% of the area median family income, which in the 2014, there was a boost in eligible basis. Let me just look at that. There was something in the 2014, added a 30% boost for applications or applicants willing to commit an additional 10% of the units of the development at 30% of AMFI. So we did create an incentive in the 2014 to encourage developers to set aside additional units at lower incomes.
And when will we know the impact of that? When are those applications due?
December. I just read that on our website. I think it's this month that they're starting to accept applications for 2014.
Well, they accept pre-applications in January, so it's like sort of like an intent to apply.
Yeah. But you want to know if they're going to add that.
The rule has been signed by the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And the next step is it gets sent to the Texas Register and then it's effective. But the application cycle, if you will, those awards won't be made until the end of July.
Yeah, but we'll know what they submitted.
Yeah,
spring.
Yeah, I mean they're due middle March, early March. Right.
Okay. Yeah, but usually March 1st is the deadline.
Right.
Pre-application has a January deadline. And then like you say, about the middle of March, you'll see all of those applications, the final applications they'll be individually scanned, and you can actually still read each of them online.
Yeah, right. That's what I was thinking, because if you're lowering it to 20%, and when you didn't get anybody taking biting on the 30%,
even more units at 30% would be incredibly helpful. 30% is really deep cut units. I mean, you know, those are really hard to find as it is. I mean, those are almost as precious as your vouchers.
Yeah, but we're talking about incentivizing, to try to go deeper, and that's
deeper,
I think that's an
30.
Option. Yeah,
deeper than 30. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
So are we okay with that one then?
Yeah.
20%? So create more incentives for deeply affordable housing, which is 20%.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the last one I captured was change policies that preclude people with criminal histories from accessing affordable housing. So it's also one that came up.
So that's a tapping key.
Excuse me?
Well, and I think just as a subset of that conversation, I don't know if the council has got somebody from TDCJ serving on it. Do they?
No.
So I wanted to lob out today, they have funding. They have housing funding. And they deploy it, with 95% of that funding goes to large step-down halfway houses. I would like us to look at doing a pilot or some sort of carve-out of that funding pot as a leverage strategy. So no new dollars, let's use it differently to do bridge funding for more appropriate housing for those with, I would say, vulnerable, whether they're physically ill, mentally ill, or intellectually disabled, because I don't think that's working well, putting those populations in these step-down halfway houses. So I'm wondering if this isn't one way to get more supportive housing in place, is to work with TDCJ about redeploying some of those halfway house dollars to go toward supportive housing for special populations.
Yeah.
Okay, so try to say that for me. It would be
it would be people coming being paroled from prison.
I was just trying to write a recommendation. It would be like leverage TDCJ funding.
Housing funding.
Okay, housing funding for projects, developments that would house individuals with disabilities and criminal histories.
Yeah, I would say to make sure they understand that it benefits them is that it's people coming out of prisons.
Hmm.
They see it's not just anybody. It's gonna benefit them.
I have a question for you on that. You know how they actually get points if the city participates in funding. What about giving a point or two for the fact that if you're going out to serve the population and you receive funding from that source. In the tax credit part.
And I'm sorry, I really couldn't quite hear that, Marty, I guess.
I'm sorry. The developers get points if they get city participation in adding funding to their to their development. And so if you're trying to advocate for housing for people, for the population you're serving, if you're, number one, setting aside units for that population, for people with criminal histories that maybe have other special needs, and you get funding from the Texas Department of Criminal Justice to do that, then basically you're eligible for maybe another bonus points to marry those two funding sources together.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
So let me see if I heard, like what we're doing right now, the recommendation similar to the previous one, additional points we were giving if you had an on-site case manager. What I think I'm hearing now is we're still talking about the qualified allocation plan, and the recommendation would be to put something in that we will give you additional points if you will allow people with criminal histories to be served in or to reside in your property.
Or set aside a certain number of units that would be targeted towards people with criminal histories. I think, Anne, you're saying in conjunction with other special needs. Is that what I'm hearing you guys say?
Yeah. I think that you got to be careful with that. Asking them to do a set-aside, because you get into some fair housing issues maybe. But I'm saying as a strategy for, developing or getting more incentives for developers to open units up to this population is leveraging funding that's already coming down through TDCJ. It's just using the development arm of it to connect with the right housing services our process for those coming out of prison. And I don't know how to write that, but I definitely don't think we can, I don't think it's, from a reentry standpoint, we wouldn't want to see a limitation. We wouldn't want them to see, at least 10% of your units have to go. You have, because that's, I don't think that, how do you choose those 10%? And if you do it by a program, like you can say, they're going to partner with TDCJ, to do a continuum of care program serving, these special populations, that's different. That's how you screen down to who gets in that. And the other thing is, I definitely don't think it ought to all be in one place. I mean, that's really what we're trying to move away from, is that, we don't want to concentrate people with serious mental illness right in the middle of a halfway house with, 300 other releasees. It's just not effective. So we're trying to, get it more deeper into the community for, true reintegration, stabilization.
Okay, so you're not necessarily talking about putting something in the qualified allocation plan then?
No. Mm-mm.
You're really talking about more of a program. And so how does the TDCJ funding work now? They give dollars to, you know, I explain.
Yeah, they have one halfway house provider for the whole state, and they provide halfway houses in, oh, I think, 6 or 7 cities, jurisdictions. And so that's how, if a person coming out of prison does not have a housing plan or anywhere to go, then they're sent to the halfway houses.
Okay.
And parole, if they're on parole and they lose housing, they can put them into the halfway house. There is a small project, very small, some housing dollars going for people going back into communities where there's not an accessible halfway house. So that if there's a county without a halfway house and there's a provider who wants to contract with them, they can do that. It's not big, it's very few units. But how the money goes down is a big contract. And this is not going to be easy to say, let's carve some of that contractual dollars and move it over here where we get into mainstream housing with case management services. But that's how the current dollars go down, policy-wise. It's one contract.
One contract for halfway houses. And so, you know, what would this, you know, maybe we could talk a little bit more about this and what this program might look like. It would still be working with, you know, developers or property, you know, management to accept individuals with criminal histories. And then with that would come some funding to TDCJ, so it would be like an incentive. If you're willing
right.
to take this person who's just left the prison, we're going to give you additional dollars for that.
Right. That's correct.
Okay. So it would be additional funding if they're willing to accept that. So that's not necessarily something that's in the QAP. That could perhaps be some kind of a notice of funding availability.
That's correct.
That you could send out that willing development, you know, could apply for.
Yeah, and I thought we were supposed to be looking for how to increase supportive housing, not just from the QAP. Is that correct? Or are we supposed to be looking at it strictly from the funding that comes down that way?
No, I think the former. I think we're looking at all avenues. Certainly, okay. The housing tax credits are the funding source that's the biggest pot. But I think we're looking beyond that, just that pot.
It's just a different way to leverage housing dollars, and that's
exactly.
We launched that conversation several years ago with TDCJ. We got a kind of a pilot that we did, and I'll be honest with you, it went really well here locally with the provider who took the money. It went really well, but then the next legislative session. There was an outcry about, you know, integrating, and it was an NIMBY thing. There was housing providers in communities that said, oh, no, TDCJ, you're not putting your people here with your money. You're going to get them out. And so they did, which is, you know, the whole other piece around how do you increase supportive housing is going to be, and I don't know if this builds into your recommendations, is how to counteract or deal with community conversations around fighting this kind of stuff.
Okay. Yeah, and I think that's a, you know, that's a really good conversation, and we can continue to work on that recommendation. I've lost my room, and so it's 11 o'clock, and so I do need to go ahead and end the call. And I just want to, you all have my contact information. Please don't feel like you have to wait until we have one of these calls to send me information, ideas. I'm in the process of really trying to develop, you know, these recommendations. The next council meeting is January 8th. I'm going to be sharing the compilation of the recommendations that we have so far. So I encourage you to, any of you who want to attend that meeting, to join us for that. We're going to talk a little bit about these, and then we're going to continue to talk about them over the next several months. So
can you send us the notice for that meeting?
Yes, it's on the website.
Okay.
January 8th at Brown Heatley in room 3501, and it's on the Housing Health Services Coordination Council website.
Okay.
If you go to Program and Services, or you can even go to the TDHCA's homepage and go to the calendar. All the information is there on TDHCA's calendar. I've already put it on the calendar.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.